WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
unjust and unjustifiable warfare, brutal torture in defiance of all conventions, illegal detentions, the fostering of terrorism, war profiteering, sky-high trade deficits, cronies and corporate insiders in high office, weak and incompetent federal agencies in favor of the Patriot Act infringements, illegal surveillance, tax cuts for the rich, corporate control of elections, lawmaking by lobbyists, political and corporate corruption, government secrecy and unaccountability, in favor of global warming, acid rain, smokestack pollution, creationism, born-again evangelicalism, imminent Armageddon and rapture, and a deceitful and dangerous neocon commitment to global hegemony. It is intolerable, I say to you, intolerable for a citizen to live under such a government in such a country.
Social philosopher and author Kirkpatrick Sale, speaking at the recent statewide convention on secession in Montpelier, Vermont. We brought you audio from that last week and will continue this week. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The most common reaction I had when I told people I was going to cover the convention was laughter. And a question, are they serious? Yes, indeed they are. And we're going to begin by hearing from Thomas Naylor on this point exactly. He's a retired Duke University economics professor. He is a co-author of Affluenza and one of the founders of the Second Vermont Republic, the host organization of the October 28th convention. Thomas Naylor.
The question I get asked most often by the media, who I've maybe never met for the first time, is, are you really serious? For starters, what is the Second Vermont Republic? The Second Vermont Republic is a peaceful, decentralized, voluntary association opposed to the tyranny of corporate America and the U.S. government, committed to the return of Vermont to its status as an independent republic and to the dissolution of the Union. What's the challenge facing the Second Vermont Republic? Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute a new government, said Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. Just as a group has a right to form, so too does it have a right to disband, to subdivide itself, or to withdraw from a larger unit. Vermont is smaller, more rural, more democratic, less violent, less commercial, more egalitarian, more humane, more independent, and more radical than most states in the Union. It provides a communitarian alternative to a dehumanized, mass production, mass consumption, narcissistic lifestyle which pervades the United States of America. Fundamental to what it means to be a Vermonter is the right of self-preservation. The time's come for us peacefully to rebel against the American empire by regaining control of our lives from big government, big business, big cities, big schools, and even big computer networks. Two, relearning how to take care of ourselves by decentralizing, downsizing, localizing, demilitarizing, simplifying, and humanizing our lives. And third, learning how to help others take care of themselves. This is a call for Vermont to reclaim its soul, to return to its rightful status as an independent republic. In so doing, Vermont can provide a kinder, gentler model for a nation obsessed with money, power, size, speed, greed, and fear of terrorism. The Second Vermont Republic stands on 8 fairly easy-to-swallow principles, which include political independence, direct democracy, sustainability, economic solidarity, quality education, humane health care, nonviolence, foreign policy based on neutrality and mutual respect. With regard to foreign policy, even though we lean towards neutrality, personally, my fantasy would be split from the United States, but what about joining New Hampshire, Maine, and the Atlantic provinces of Canada to create a little country about the size of Denmark, which we might call New Acadia. But different members have different views. Some would like to see us join Canada as the 10th province, or join Quebec. I don't know whether the Quebecois would want us or not. The problem with secession is it's one of the few topics that liberals and conservatives can agree on. Secession is anathema. I mean, it's bad. Secession is a sign of failure. It's something to be avoided like the plague. And with conservatives, like people like Ronald Reagan and to some extent even George W. Bush, they talk decentralization, they talk devolution. I mean, Reagan wrote a speech back in the 80s, one of the best speeches ever given on devolution, and yet he was probably the biggest spender on military affairs of all time up until that particular moment. The problem with the conservatives is that their nationalism always trumps their decentralist tendencies. Liberals, on the other hand, and to be very specific, the group we have the most problem with in Vermont are the people who vote for Bernie Sanders and call themselves Vermont progressives. The problem with Vermont progressives is, I mean, they hate Bush, okay? They hate Bush. But they know that in their heart of hearts, the only possible way to solve any of our problems is through the federal government. And so they can't handle the notion that Vermont might be able to solve some of its own problems and maybe serve as a model to the rest of the nation on how to get its act together. There are usually 3 questions that people ask about secession. Is it constitutional? If we were able to pull it off, could we survive economically? And is it politically feasible? And I will address each of those 3 questions. Most Americans assume it's unconstitutional, illegal, and heaven forbid, Vermont could never make it as an independent republic. In terms of constitutionality, there are at least 3 arguments to support the notion that it is constitutional. One is that, essentially, that the U.S. Constitution is a compact of sovereign states. And you don't forego sovereignty by joining such a compact unless you explicitly agree to do that. And there's no such agreement between Vermont and the compact or any other of the 49 states. 3 of the original 13 states, Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island, actually had written into their constitutions escape clauses that allowed them to split if they didn't like what was going on. Well, if 3 states had a right to split, what about the other 47? Before the Civil War, a dozen or so states had nullified the Constitution, meaning that they had taken a position that a particular law was in violation of their respective state constitutions. Vermont was such a state in 1858. We nullified the Constitution in regard to the Fugitive Slave Act. We said we're not willing to participate in capturing freed slaves from the South. We didn't want any part of that. And then there's the 10th Amendment, which is perhaps the most potent, which essentially says if the Constitution doesn't say that it's a no-no, then it's left to the states, and the Constitution does not say it's a no-no. But part of the problem is that our political leaders since Lincoln have been in such denial that there's really, nothing, there's no law, there's nothing in the Constitution, there's no legal paradigm that we can follow. But more on that in a few minutes. In terms of economic feasibility, the argument goes, how could Vermont survive? And my take is, not only will it survive, it could flourish. By just being Vermont. Of the 200 independent nation states in the world, 50 of them have populations smaller than Vermont. We have 620,000 people, and there are 50 countries in the world who have smaller populations than that. Of the 10 richest countries in the world by per capita income, believe it or not, 5 of those are smaller than Vermont. They include Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, the Channel Islands, Iceland, and Bermuda. Admittedly, 2 or 3 of those are special cases because they're tax haven. But Iceland's an interesting case. I mean, it's like about 400,000 people. I mean, all Iceland's got is a bunch of underground hot springs and a lot of fish. And they're one of the top 10 richest countries in the world, and a lot smaller than we are. Sometimes people confuse secession with economic isolation, and that's not what we're talking about. There's 600 Vermont firms who export abroad. I would assume they would continue exporting abroad. Why not? We import and export both ways to the rest of the world about $3 billion, more or less, in each direction. And then the one that some people love to pick on is for every dollar that we give to the feds, we get back about $1.14. You say, well, how could we possibly afford to make this split without much difficulty? What that argument overlooks is that's about $500 million if you add it all up. And you say, maybe that's a reasonable amount of money. But that doesn't take into consideration the unfunded and underfunded mandated programs in which we have to play whether we like it or not. And those are hard-earned Vermont dollars not included in that $1 that I just quoted you. So it's probably a wash. It could even conceivably be a net gain. And I can go on. I mean, people worry about Social Security. As a recipient, I mean, if the federal government doesn't pay me my $1,100 a month, I mean, really all bets are off. I mean, that's a contract between the U.S. government and me as an individual. It doesn't matter whether I live in Saudi Arabia, the U.K., or Vermont. So don't sweat it in terms of your personal Social Security. Medicare is a different breed of cat because Medicare pays almost nothing if you get ill across the border. So, Vermont will have to come up with its own health care system. I think the present debate between the governor and the legislature, borders on being inane. I mean, one is calling for a single-payer system, and the other is some kind of free market system, neither of which are going to work. I'm much more, we don't have time to go into this, intrigued by the Swiss model, in which they have 400 independent insurance companies, some private, some publicly owned, and about 98% of the people are insured in Switzerland. You don't fix the national health care system of the U.S., that's the null set, that's not possible, or Vermont by claiming we're going to all be the same. You ultimately have to get the patient, the physician, the hospital, and the insurer in some kind of sense of connectedness. And you don't do that by building bigger hospitals, bigger clinics, and bigger health insurance companies. So what about the political feasibility of secession? The decision to secede is a radical act of rebellion, grounded in fear and anger, but also driven by a positive vision of the future and a number of external events. This kind of four-step process includes, first of all, denunciation. I did that this morning, and some of our other speakers did too. The thrust of it being the U.S. has lost its moral authority. It's unsustainable, ungovernable, and unfixable. Denunciation. The second step is disengagement. I don't want to be part of this. Do you want to go down with the Titanic, or do you want to seek other options while they're still on the table? Three is demystification. That's part of what this convention is about, is to try and demystify secession. Secession is a viable option. It's constitutional. It's constitutionally, politically, and economically feasible. And finally, the fourth one is defiance. I personally want to help take back Vermont from big business, big markets, and big government, and I want to do so peacefully. We have no illusion that the Second Vermont Republic, I'm asked this all the time by the media too, you know, how are you going to persuade the people of Vermont to secede? I mean, how many people are with you now? Well, the answer is I don't know how many people, but the number is growing much faster by the day. I mean, basically, every time George Bush opens his mouth, we recruit more members, and the price of gold goes up, and the two are not unrelated, because gold is an investment of last resort. When the world's going to hell in a handbasket, people invest in gold, and gold is at an 18-year high this very week, and that's not by chance alone. We're not going to convince the people of Vermont to secede. That's the work of George W. Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Hillary Clinton, the cheap oil endgame that we heard this fantastic lecture from James Howard Kunstler about. The cheap oil endgame may be the single most important factor we've got going that's going to push the people of Vermont over the brink. The collapse of the dollar, all it takes is one move on the part of the Chinese, backing away from the dollar, growing resentment and competing with us for the dwindling supply of oil, and they say they don't want to take any more of our treasury bonds, and the dollar goes into a complete tailspin, and you know, Katie bar the door. I think Bush is in such deep trouble these days. I mean, if you look at what Reagan, Bush 1, Slick Willie, and Bush 2 all have in common, in addition to being pathological liars, is that every time they got in trouble politically, they bombed someone. I mean, the American people love it when we bomb particularly some third world country that's a small fraction the size of us. And I mean, it seems to me we're just, I mean, you know, I would be very nervous if I lived in Syria or Iran at the present time. They seem like sitting ducks. Another act of terrorism, a significant further encroachment in civil liberties, possibly a declaration of martial law, and of course, what would instantaneously bring Vermonters on board, particularly the apathetic college and high school kids, would be a restatement of the military draft. But I actually don't think they're that stupid. I was more worried about that a couple of years ago. They're such free market zealots, and they do understand what brought an end to the Vietnam War back in the mid-70s. So what we're saying is all we can do with a convention like this is lay it out and say secession is an option. These are some of the benefits. We think it's economically, we think it's constitutional and politically feasible. In terms of our objectives, kind of operational objectives, we're really strategic objectives. It's threefold. We want the approval of a statewide convention called to consider one and only one issue, secession. We want recognition by the U.S. government and other states, and we want diplomatic recognition abroad. So in a sense, the Second Vermont Republic has three constituencies: the people of Vermont, the U.S. government and the other states, and the rest of the world. And if we're to succeed, we have to play to all three of them. And it's not by chance that that's the way we're positioning ourselves. The next step is to persuade the Vermont legislature to have a real convention. We all know this is a pretend convention, but it's kind of nice to call it a convention nevertheless. A real convention in proportion to the population. The Vermont legislature has 180 people in it, so let's say 200 people elected from around the state, to come to this chamber to consider one and only one issue, namely Articles of Secession. And we need probably a two-thirds vote. Simple majority won't cut it, because the name of the game is recognition. It's approval. It's got to be a major statement. So two-thirds of the vote. We win the two-thirds vote, and as I said before, there's no law, there's no legal paradigm, there's nothing in the legislature. We have no laws, nothing in the Constitution that tells us how to do this. If we were Canadian, it'd be a lot easier, because in 98, when Chrétien was prime minister, he appealed to the Ottawa Supreme Court, raised the question, is it constitutionally feasible for a province to split? He expected the answer was going to be no, because he was still fighting with Quebec. The answer came back, yes, it's not a pushover, but here are the conditions. It's definitely doable. We have no such paradigm, so we have to kind of invent our own with some rather good legal advice. So we got to have a statewide convention. It's passed by two-thirds. We go to Washington with the Declaration of Articles of Secession and give it to anybody that'll take it. I mean, the president, the vice president, the Speaker of the House, the head of the Supreme Court, anybody will take it. We simultaneously seek diplomatic recognition from Ottawa, London, Paris, the United Nations, Stockholm, Bern, important, influential countries in the world. We need their legitimacy, as I'll explain in a minute. Then we come back to Vermont, and the moment of truth is we start behaving as though we think we really did it. We don't follow the rules, and we stop paying taxes, and then we pray a lot. And then the next question from the press is, and how will the U.S. government react to this? You know, will they snuff out tiny Vermont? And my answer is maybe, maybe not, but I think it's improbable. And why do I think so? Well, I then draw a strong analogy from East Europe in the 1980s. When the Solidarity Movement first emerged in 1981, it was widespread belief in the United States that the Soviets would snuff out Solidarity. They wouldn't allow it to happen. The argument was, look what happened in Budapest in 1956, in Prague in 68. The Soviets won't tolerate this. They never intervened. Certainly the Soviets were capable of intervening. Of course, by the time Gorbachev came on board in 85, there was a lot less interest in intervention. And in 1989, to the amazement of the world, all six former Soviet allies, satellites as we call them, rid themselves of their communist regimes. Five of the six of them managed to do this nonviolently. Romania was the bloody exception to the rule. So how did they avoid any kind of military intervention? Well, Poland had a lot of good friends, not the least of which was the USA, the Roman Catholic Church, well thought of in Europe, the rest of the world. The world was behind the Solidarity Movement. Well, now we are back to, I mean, it wouldn't have played well for the Soviets to invade Warsaw. So what about Vermont? It's classic David and Goliath. What could possibly be more absurd than tiny Vermont with 620,000 people standing up to the greatest economic and political empire of all time and saying, we don't like it, we're leaving. This is truly ridiculous. But see, therein lies the energy. I mean, that's what energizes Vermonters, and it's what energizes our other two constituencies. I mean, we got lots of attention from a tiny conference last November in Middlebury that Kirkpatrick will talk about, attended by a whopping 40 people. But it was picked up by La Devoir in Montreal, and it spread all over the world. I mean, that Vermont was doing this. They liked it. I mean, they were all very, very supportive. It was in newspapers all over Europe. So it's this absurdity, it's David and Goliath that provides a lot of the energy. And it throws the burden really back on the U.S. government. It doesn't matter whether we have a liberal, a conservative, a Democratic, a Republican. They would not be amused. You know, they're not going to like this idea. Would they invade Vermont? I actually think not, but it puts them in a real quandary. I mean, if they invaded, would they destroy the black and white Holsteins? Would they burn off the sugar maples? Imagine trying to enslave independent Vermonters. I mean, that's easier said than done. And you know, suppose they did. I mean, we could always appeal to Canada. The United Nations, and maybe even NATO would come to our rescue if we were being attacked by the empire. To go back to my five countries that I said, five rich countries smaller than us, let's review the bidding on where they stand militarily. If they achieve their economic prominence militarily, the most heavily armed of those five countries is Luxembourg. The last time I checked, they had a standing army of 900. Bermuda and Iceland are under the protection of NATO, whatever that means. Liechtenstein has been neutral since 1866. It has no army whatsoever. And the Channel Islands are under British military authority. People say, you know, how would Vermont defend itself? Well, I mean, for starters, why would anyone want to attack Vermont? I mean, we have no strategic military resources. We have very few military contractors. General Dynamics is an exception. IBM exceptions to the rule. I mean, the only strategic resource we've got is an ailing nuclear power plant down around Bellows Falls. There are no big cities. There are no big buildings. There's nothing. You know, who would want Vermont? To go back to, I mean, Costa Rica has not had an army since 1948. To go back to General Allen, is he? Oh, there, the general's still here. In 1777, Ethan Allen took Fort Ticonderoga without firing a single shot. 75. Oh, slip of the tongue. Sorry. If Vermont can succeed in undermining the moral authority of the U.S. government and convince the rest of the world that the U.S. government is corrupt to the core, then it too may be able to escape from the Union without ever firing a shot. So, to conclude very briefly, how does the Second Vermont Republic work? You know, what are we trying to do about this? Obviously, holding conventions like this, we hope to do it again annually. As I said before, the Second Vermont Republic is really a kind of a loose association, voluntary association of like thinking people. We're not all the same, you know, political persuasion. It's all over the place. But at one level, it's a group of independent entrepreneurs with a very weak center who run a series of projects. I mean, hands down, the most successful one is the one that Ian Balling started, I guess, about a year ago, called the Vermont Commons, that now comes out monthly. It's a 12-page newspaper. It's also included as an insert in the Vermont Guardian. He and Ian Jacobson, Rob Williams, do the newspaper. Then there's a companion website, vtcommons.org, that Rob Williams is the webmaster of. It has its own blog. Vermont Republic itself, vermontrepublic.org, has a website. I mean, the Vermont Commons is kind of takes issues more deeply, longer pieces coming from the newspaper that appear on the website. The Vermont Republic tends to be shorter, more, you know, what is the Second Vermont Republic rationale underlying it, what are we about? So there's Vermont Commons, two websites. We commemorate about a half a dozen or so different events. We celebrate January 15th, although this year it'll be January 14th since it's a Saturday, Vermont Independence Day. A celebration at the Langdon Street Cafe last year precipitated a statewide resolution eventually passed by the legislature. Both houses passed it unanimously. It was to have been a bill to make January 15th Vermont Independence Day. It turned out they gave us a whole month. January became Vermont Independence Month and Vermont History Month to avoid a conflict between Westminster and Windsor as to which was the most significant date in Vermont history, when we declared independence or when the Constitution was signed, and the legislature in its wisdom wished to duck that issue, and so they gave us a whole month. But the point was, they knew who sponsored this. John and Linda Whitney, two of our members, came up with the idea and really sold it almost single-handedly to the legislature, and they knew what business they were in. The March 4th, we hold an annual funeral commemorating the day that Vermont joined the Union in 1791. Last year's funeral featured the Reverend Matchstick, started from the Langdon Street Cafe. He wrote a eulogy. I read from Ecclesiastes with Chopin's Death March in the background, and then a kind of New Orleans-style marching band came to the front steps of the State House, and we lay the coffin of the First Republic at the feet of Ethan Allen. And General Allen was an active participant. We also, for the first time, participated in the July 9th celebration down in Windsor, the day that the Constitution was signed, and that's going to become an annual event. And then this convention, and Rob Williams may or may not say something about a future event we're planning in May called 2020. Another spinoff activity is the Middlebury Institute, which came out of the conference last November. I mean, one of the characteristics of the Second Vermont Republic is we take relatively few votes in the organization so far, and you better be careful if you propose that we do something, because it's very unlikely that we will say no. It's more like, okay, go for it. You find the money. We'll be your cheerleader, and we will encourage you and, you know, proceed. In the case of the Free Vermont, Rob will introduce them, but it's a much younger group who want to be more grassroots. Some of their ideas may be more or less radical than the old Codgers who started this organization. But it's one more example of the spirit of what we try to do. So I didn't leave a whole lot of questions, time for questions, but to conclude, what do we need from you? If we're going to prevail, which I am convinced that we will prevail, the Second Vermont Republic needs more members. We have a couple of hundred members now. Membership costs $35 a pop. But we really won't make it on $35 a member. We need some people who are willing to make significant financial contributions to the Second Vermont Republic. And so we invite you to continue to consider that. For those of you who remain skeptical when we leave at 5 o'clock, my advice to you is, after three more years of George W. Bush, what the Second Vermont Republic is proposing today is going to seem like kid stuff. Otherwise, long live the Second Vermont Republic, and God bless the disunited states of America. Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Naylor of the Second Vermont Republic. I suspect many people here honor the memory of President Lincoln and the principles behind the Civil War. I'm struggling to balance that.
Right. I would recommend you read Thomas DiLorenzo's book of a couple of years ago on Lincoln. He makes a pretty compelling case that contrary to what most Americans believe, the Civil War really was not about freeing the slaves, that the Civil War, the bottom line of the Civil War, was about preserving the empire and about the Union. That Lincoln made some very racist statements before the Civil War, and that, in effect, that the abolition of slavery, he could go either way, but if it would help the empire, we'll go for it. I mean, that's kind of the essence of it. A look at DiLorenzo, I think you'll be a lot less enthusiastic. I mean, the Lincoln myth is very powerful in this country. It is particularly powerful in Vermont, and a lot of it's not true.
So presumably you would have been in favor of South Carolina seceding back then?
Yes, I think that South Carolina and the Confederate States had a perfect right to secede. Yeah, I think they had a right to secede then. So if South Carolina wants to secede, I mean, I even have no objection to Killington seceding. I abhor the reasons why they want to secede, but I think Killington has a right to secede, as did South Carolina.
You characterize the Vermont Progressives as being in favor of the federal government. I'm a member of the Vermont Progressives Party Committee in Brattleboro, and most of my colleagues down there would not agree with your characterization. We're concerned with bringing people together across the political spectrum to dialogue on this issue.
I'm encouraged by your answer.
First of all, how did this House chamber even become available for this discussion? And secondly, do we even have any representatives present at this session?
I had lunch with at least one state senator. I don't know how many others there. But don't put them on the spot. It's actually a very relevant question. I mean, we're going to start to become much more aggressive. I mean, we invited, we sent invitations to every legislator. And I didn't answer your first question. Don't let me forget that. That's kind of funny. But we also sent personal invitations to the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the congressional delegation. Only two of them, the governor and Jeffords, responded until I issued a press release 2 weeks ago, and Sanders and Leahy then declined. I followed up my original invitations with a letter saying, I understand you're very busy and predisposed, but could you send us a short statement of your views on Vermont independence movement? And the only one who answered was Leahy, and he of course, said thanks but no thanks. But the point is, an issue of this importance, maybe the most important issue to emerge in this state in over 200 years, that these guys have no opinion on this. They take no position. I don't think we can tolerate that. And, I mean, just to kind of take it one step further, not to pick on the progressives, but maybe just a little bit on Bernie Sanders. Probably the most popular political person in the state. 2 months ago, I went to a fundraiser for Sanders, and he made his pitch. I mean, I could have given his speech. It was basically railing, vintage Bernie, railing against the Senate, corrupt to the core. That was the punchline of his speech. I waited for the Q&A to begin. And then I jumped in and I said, enjoyed your speech, Congressman. I agree, U.S. Senate is indeed corrupt to the core. But I have two questions. If the U.S. Senate is corrupt to the core, why do you want to be in the United States Senate? You really can't have it both ways. To pretend that you're doing good and accepting money from the U.S. government and the U.S. Senate, which you have just told us is corrupt to the core. My second question was, wouldn't it be a lot more fun to be the president of your own little country, the independent Democratic Republic of Vermont? He smiled and said, after I'm elected to the Senate. Now, you laugh, but that's the essence of why we're here. Because these guys, see, they want it both ways. They want to be paid by the U.S. government. The U.S. government is the enemy. I mean, I think what would have been a great Senate race, I was really sad Doobie backed out and is not running against Bernie. Because you got Doobie, the American Airlines captain, so, you know, he likes big business. American Airlines is no small company. He flies for the Air National Guard. So he likes big business. He likes big military. We've got Bernie, on the other hand. Bernie is world-class supporter of big government. He loves big social welfare states and big cities. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're in the same business. I mean, bigness is the problem. And so it doesn't matter whether it's a big business or big government. They're both bad. And so, you know, how? You can't have it both ways. Okay, it's Rob's time. Oh, yes. Oh, it takes very special connections. You call up the sergeant-at-arms and say, we would like to have a convention. Who are you? Second Vermont Republic. He sends me a questionnaire. I had 5 questions, very simple questions. I send it back to him. I think his secretary got it on Friday. And on Monday, he calls back and says, Speaker of the House, Gay Symington, who is not a secessionist, has approved your application. And only in Vermont is that possible, because they knew, you know, I sent them the book, all the documents, saying they knew exactly what business was. But you have one more question. You left out your own follow-up question. You've got to ask them, how much did it cost? Well, we decided we were going to live it up, and they wanted us to leave at 4. We're going to stay to 5. I expect to be invoiced $35. It's called the People's House. Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Naylor of the Second Vermont Republic.
Good afternoon. My name is Rob Williams, and I am the associate publisher and the web editor for a new monthly newspaper in Vermont. It's called the Vermont Commons. It looks like this. This is the brand new issue, just hot off the press, up from the southern part of the state. You can be the first to read it. We've got copies out on the back table. The featured article this month, called The Democracy Now, with a question mark issue, is an article by the country's foremost scholar on secession. His name is Donald Livingston. He's a professor at Emory University. And I would encourage all of you, if you're interested in finding solutions to the problems that were outlined this morning, that you consider supporting the work that we're doing. So we're really glad you're here today. I'd like to invite our panelists up. I've just asked all the panelists to introduce themselves so as not to take up too much time. And the plan is for each of us just to talk for no more than 10 minutes apiece, and then we really would like to open it up for more conversation from the floor from all of you. So without further ado, Dennis Morisot.
Thank you, Ron. I do not think I will match the eloquence of this morning's speakers, but I'll give it my best shot. I'm Denny Morisot. I'm a retired businessman from the Burlington area, now living in West Paulet. I am also, as of June 22, a declared candidate for Bernie's seat in the U.S. Congress. I indicated in the declaration speech, after I said how terrified I was to take such a step, I indicated that I would run, have run before, that I would run as an independent in the general election in any event, but would stand in the Republican primary first for many good reasons, and not the least of which is I believe, and I said at the time, the first order of business of the next Congress is the impeachment of Richard Cheney and George W. Bush. We have to accomplish that. I'm very mindful of what we are here and what the fundamental discussion is, and I'm a supporter of the idea, a firm supporter of it, that if we cannot, in fact, straighten out our federal government, we ought to get the hell out. Yay! You are hired. That from a retired businessman, independent / Republican. I wasn't born a Republican. I had to earn it. And then when I finally did earn it, the leadership turned into the N people. But I'm still sort of there. So in answer to if there are no, I don't know if I'm really a politician or not, but I'm certainly running, and I'm here. And I'm very proud to be here. I think I have some how-tos that are applicable not only to the last chance to fix our national government, but are also applicable to what we here really need to be thinking about that we could do here in Vermont to achieve the independence or to achieve a motion towards secession. It's frankly this simple. You have to become the legislature. There is no other option. There's a whole hell of a lot of you here from various towns and various districts in the state of Vermont. If you imagine, if you hope, if you pray, as we all have done for so long, that you can, by a convention, or by demonstrations, or by speeches, or by pleading with those who supposedly represent us today, if you imagine that you can get their approval for our independence, you are smoking something illegal. It cannot be done. You will never persuade them. We will never persuade the Congress of the United States, this Congress, to impeach this president and vice president. It will not happen that way. You have to become the legislature. That means you have to stand for election. There is no other option. And you haven't heard an action plan today until now. That's it. I'm trying to do that nationally for a couple of reasons. One, we have our attention constantly diverted because we're somewhat celebrity addicted and we're all somewhat media addicted, and our attention always gets focused on the presidential elections. And after that, it gets focused on what I call Yankee Red Sox politics. You know, the Democrat doofuses against the Republican doofuses. The Republicans are really bad. And those damn Democrats, well, they just talk. That's all they do. That's their job. I'm sorry. I was in that party a long time ago when I ran for Congress 3 times in this state in 1970. And 71 and 74. They talk. They are members of the club. They drink with the other team. They spend their time with the other team. They trade votes back and forth with the other team. And their job, when the going gets tough, when the sledding gets a little sticky, their job is then, with permission of the other team, to turn to us, put a smile on their face, say, I'm a Democrat and we're going to fix this, and shake your hand and take your money and take your time and take your energy. They're all together in it. They're all complicit. Listen to these statistics. In the last congressional election, well, in every congressional election, let's forget the Senate for a moment. In every congressional election, 430 seats in the U.S. House are up for grabs. 430. Let's say, in any given year, 30 of those incumbents retire or die. So we're working with a round number. 400 incumbent congressmen ran in the last election for re-election. 400 of them. How many? Quick, how many were defeated? Quick. 4. 1 in 100. And in the election before, you have to get rid of the 4 that Tom DeLay screwed around with in Texas because they don't count. Made a technical total of 8, but those weren't real. In the last election, before that, 400 ran. 4 were replaced. And the big success, what was the big success with those replacements? A Democrat replaced a Republican, or a Republican replaced a Democrat. Big deal. The goddamn Politburo in the Soviet Union had more turnover than that. You cannot crack that entity one by one, state by state, legislature by legislature, unless we unite and do it all. What I'm trying to do is this, and I need your help. I'm not just running myself, and even if I were to succeed in Vermont, and I'm going to try, my intention is not to join that thing. Way back when I ran as a much younger and more aggressive and somewhat better-looking man, the second time I ran, Bernie Sanders was my speechwriter. So I go way, way, way back with Bernie. I knew him within 6 months of the time he came to the state from the University of Chicago. And as you know, I've just told you, I ran 3 times on an anti-Vietnam War platform and just missed twice and then got killed. And Bernie took over the party that I had formed and then became mayor of Burlington and went on. And finally, as he was about to take the seat that I had coveted for so long, I sat briefly with him and gave him some advice. I said, first, you're not going down there to join it, Bernie. You're going down there to take it apart. Show it to us. Expose it. Show it to us. 1. 2, don't spend all your time fooling around the way the other guys do. Sit in the stream like a Vermont trout and wait. When the issue comes down, when that issue comes down the stream, tumbling toward you, and it's really one you want to bite on, and it's one all the rest of the Congress is opposed to, that's the issue you want. That's the issue you fight for. Because, 1, it's right, and 2, it will make you, in the scale, the equal of the other 434, and that is the way forward. So what I'm proposing, in addition to running here in Vermont, and that kind of strategy, should I succeed, is one other thing. I've said I will recruit, and I am attempting to do this, I will recruit candidates for the Congress to run as independents all over the country. Why? Because Congress has the power. They write the laws. They write the tax laws. They collect the taxes. They fund everything that government does, and they can decide not to fund it. Congress is the power. And when things go bad, they put their little cardboard president out in front of us, and we all get diverted. Congress is the power. And here's what I'm thinking. If you saw the Dean phenomena, and I watched it very closely. I've been a student of politics for about 50 years. I watched it very closely. No, Howard. Howard did an amazing thing there, and he couldn't have done it unless it were possible to do. It wasn't that he did it. It was that it was suddenly possible to do, and he raised millions and millions of dollars and thousands and thousands and thousands of volunteers. And he got awfully close before his own mistakes did him in. He got very close. We could do that with the congressional election, and here's the plan. There's How to Take Power is right there, sitting in a stack of papers, along with a couple of petitions. If you wouldn't mind signing them, I'd appreciate it, and some literature. This is how you do it. I'm running now. I've said I'll run as an independent. I've said I will recruit others, and I am trying. When I recruit the first one, I've had six almost and fade because it's a scary thing to do. When I succeed and get the first one, we will be two. Independence, running linked. When that person announces, we'll do a linked announcement. That will be the first time in United States history such a thing has been done. It has never been done before. If the media doesn't like that, we too, the two of us, will find a third, makes it half as hard. And when we find a third, we will announce again, all three of us, the new person plus the two. And if the media doesn't like that or doesn't think that's significant, we three will find a fourth. I don't care from where, Colorado, Oregon, from anywhere. And we'll have a linked announcement. Now, my sense of this is that by the time we reach four or five, maybe sooner, even this bought and sold and lazy and butt-kissing media will notice something is happening here. And they'll write about it. As soon as they write about it, it'll be a lot easier to get to five and six and seven. It'll be a lot easier to get up somewhere around 10. 10 people sworn to recruit others, sworn to be independent, sworn to represent you. And if we get to 8 or 9 or 10, I guarantee you, remember what Howard did. If we get there, we'll leap to 100 and 200. And at that point, money raising gets easier, staff gets easier, the whole thing gets easier. And long before the election, which is, after all, a year away, long before that, if we accomplish this, long before that election, we will be able to lean on this president now and this Congress now, because they will see what's coming. They will see us coming. That's the only way this old political science graduate and old dog politician has been able to conjure in 50 years of observation. That is the only way I can see that we are going to save this country, because it is in the toilet now. All they're doing is consolidating. We don't stop them prior to this congressional election. We'll have to secede. And I'll do so willingly. Thank you.
We're just going to ask that you hold questions until the end, because we're going to have a lot of time to talk. Next up, my good friend, my neighbor, a man who deserves as much credit for getting Vermont Commons off the ground these past 6 months as anyone else in the room, Rowan Jacobson.
Hi, I'm Rowan. I'm one of the editors on Vermont Commons. And unless I'm mistaken, we have a pretty partisan crowd here today. So I'm going to try to speak a little bit for the vast majority of people in the state who think that this is one of the stupidest ideas we could have ever come up with. Because I think it's important that we remember that majority is out there, more than we have today, and come up with answers for their objections and with plans for how secession could ultimately succeed. Yesterday, when Thomas Naylor was speaking about this on the radio, a man called in. His voice was shaking with anger just at this very idea. And one, he said, the United States would never let you do that in a million years. And he also said, I'm a patriot, and I just hate this idea to the core. So let's talk about the United States part of that first. And I'm hoping that in the general discussion, maybe we can explore this a little bit more. But I think he's right. The United States would never let us do that in a million years.